ladies and gentlemen, President Bill Clinton.
Good afternoon. Ladies and gentlemen, we have four more commitments to announce to begin this session in the afternoon. The first one is one in which I have been deeply involved. We had a press conference on this in New York, but it's not widely known, so I want to, the people who put this together did it with a view toward making a major contribution to CGI and to their work in the world. So I'd like to ask Frank Giustra, Carlos Slim, Lucas Lundin, Luis Moreno, the director of the Inter-American Development Bank, Paul Reynolds, Frank Holmes from U.S. Global Investors, Steve Gottsfeld from Newmont Mining, David Parker from Tech Comico Limited, Jose Arada from Pacific Strauss Energy, Sally Eyre from Petro Rubiales Energy Corporation, Peter Sinclair from Barrick Gold, Valerie Short from Deloitte and Touche, to come up here, please. In addition to the companies and individuals represented on this stage, Endeavor Financial, GMP Securities, SXR Uranium One, Robert Cross Coal Corporation, Peak Gold Limited, Stephen Dattels, Ernst & Young, and the Prospectors and Developers Association of Canada are all parties to this commitment. It begins with more than $300 million for what we have called the Clinton-Giustra Sustainable Growth Initiative. It is an innovative partnership between the private sector, governments, and NGOs in an effort to increase the effectiveness, impact, scale, and sustainability of global of social and economic development efforts in countries where the natural resources industry is a permanent part of the economy. Now, let me put that in plainer language. The man to my right here, Frank Giustra, is a good friend of mine who has been of immeasurable help to our work in fighting HIV/AIDS around the world. I would like to take credit for this idea, but it actually was his. He came to me, I don't know, maybe nearly a year ago, and said, you know, we do mining in all these places in the world, and 60% of the world's mining wealth is in companies traded on the Toronto Stock Exchange. Hard for an American to admit. And he said, we go into these countries and we mine, and sometimes the conditions are good and sometimes they're not so good, depending on what the local laws are. And then when we leave, sometimes the people can't make a living anymore. So we would like to promote sustainable, environmentally responsible development that helps ordinary families, both while the mining operations are in place and then when we go when the mines are played out, so that the people will still have a means of making a living and sustaining their natural environment. This is a stunning effort. He committed the first $100 million. Carlos Slim committed $100 million. Lucas Lundin committed $100 million. And we had enough money to start in three Latin American countries, Peru, Colombia, and Mexico, two African countries, Ghana and Zambia. And before we knew it, within like a week, 24 other companies had contacted us with operations in Latin America, Africa, and Asia, saying they wanted to be a part of this initiative. And I also want to say my former foreign policy aide, Eric Nonax, accepted Frank's invitation to move to Canada to try to help start up this initiative. This has the potential to drastically alter in a positive way the economic and social impact that mining operations have all over the world, and to change the sort of the whole way of thinking about how they relate to local communities, to countries, and to average people who make their living working in the mine or serving those who do, and making a sustainable economic and environmentally responsible impact that will last for decades after the mining operations are over. I am very proud and honored to be a part of this. As I say, we're starting with more than $300 million in commitments now. As the project evolves, we expect it will raise much, much more for sustainable development around the world. So I am looking forward to this. I think these people have done something truly historic. We realize that we have a heavy responsibility to make this work. As far as I can tell, there's no real precedent for it. And we're going to have to make a little of it up as we go along with help from the people and all the countries and the communities affected. But they have a chance to affect millions of lives in a positive way. And I ask you to give them all a hand. I'd like to now ask Dr. Peter Hotez, the president of Savin Vaccines Institute, Dikembe Mutombo of the Dikembe Mutombo Foundation, who once claimed to be my half-brother. I never denied it, but I am bitter about getting the short end of the gene pool. And I'd like to, and Michael Kempner, the president and CEO of the MWW Group. We both, Dikembe and I both went to Georgetown University, and as you can see, it was more of a growth experience for him. In addition to these three, the other people making the commitments include Alyssa Milano, TIG Global, the Global Network for Neglected Tropical Disease Control. They are making a $25 million commitment to develop an advocacy campaign to help tackle treatable, neglected tropical diseases which cause disfiguring and life-threatening parasitic and bacterial infections. Such diseases, even though they don't affect any individual one, don't affect nearly as many people as AIDS, TB, and malaria, or the maternal and child health problems that plague so much of the developing world, in the aggregate, afflict and stigmatize more than a billion people living in the most impoverished areas of the developing world. The partners will launch a Stop NTDs program to establish four new or expanded neglected tropical disease control programs by 2009, providing access to essential medicines to fight the diseases, and advocating for immediate action, providing treatment for 50 million people who suffer from these neglected tropical diseases in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. This is a huge commitment. And things that are so often overlooked. For example, America closed its last leprosy study center and treatment center in Carville, Louisiana, 41 years ago. But in 1985, there were still 5.2 million cases of leprosy in the world. Today, because of efforts against that disease, the number is down to 220,000. We can have the same exact impact in all the other diseases that this effort will attack. So I am profoundly grateful to all of them, and I hope you are too. Thank you. I had a little fun at Dikembe's expense, but I also want to thank him as he sits down for being a faithful son of the Congo and continuing to work on healthcare problems when his country was torn apart, innocent people were dying. He never gave up on them, and I thank you for that, too. Now I'd like to ask Martha Stewart to come up here. We announced this program on her television show the other day, which aired yesterday morning, but just on the off chance that not all of you watched it, we're going to do it again. This is a very important healthcare issue for the United States and particularly for all other developed countries. She has made a $2 million commitment to provide caregivers and doctors with an easily accessible and indispensable resource to help care for sick and aging parents and other family members and loved ones. Learning from the best practices developed by physicians at Mount Sinai here in New York, the project will produce an online resource and curriculum for caregivers of the sick and aging. By delivering such resources online and through a network of doctors and medical students, they'll be able to reach millions of caregivers throughout the world. This means a lot to Martha Stewart because of her experience caring for her own mother. Today in this country, more than 50 million Americans are caring for a family member or a friend with a chronic illness, disability, or advanced age. The number is certain to grow as the percentage of population 65 or over will rise in the coming years. Now, if you're an American, let me just make a statement. There is only one category in which the United States ranks first in health care. None. No other. If you live to be 65 in the United States, you are in the oldest population on earth. Women have a chance to live the probabilities they'll live to be nearly 85. Men will live to be between 82 and 83 on average. I had a similar experience that Martha did. My 91-year-old stepfather passed away in April. And for the last year or so, he was able to live at home with extended care just because I and his daughter and son-in-law had the resources to take care of him. But all over America, people are struggling with this. And you're going to see it more and more in other wealthy countries and increasingly in developing countries as the job base grows, but the institutional options for caring for parents don't. This is a profoundly important thing because what we're trying to do here is to make it possible for people who aren't as fortunate economically as Martha and I are to do the same thing without bankrupting the hospital system, bankrupting the institutionalized care system, and improving the quality of life of our older citizens as they come toward the end of it. This has a potentially major impact, not only in this country, but all over the world, and I am very grateful to her for this commitment. Thank you very much. Now, I would like to ask Craig Barrett, the chairman of Intel Corporation, and Brenda Masili, the director of Intel Education and the president of the Intel Foundation, to come up here. The organizations involved in this commitment are not only our Intel and the ministries of education in 15 nations. The Intel Teach program will train teachers online to integrate technology into the classroom, thereby helping students develop key skills necessary for success in the global economy. It will train over 1.5 million teachers in 15 countries on how to do this by working with the ministers of education to ensure cooperation with local and national curricula and education standards. It will impact tens of millions of students. Studies show that students in technology-rich environments have increased achievement in preschool through higher education for both regular and special needs children. Computer education is more cost-effective in raising student achievement than class size reduction, increasing instructional time, or tutoring programs. I might also just make two other points here that aren't in my notes. First of all, there is lots of evidence that some people learn better by interacting with technology than they do from just listening in the classroom. Secondly, this has potentially even greater positive impacts in developing countries than in developed ones. We have a huge shortage, as John Wood, one of the other honorees that was up here earlier, can tell you, in many poor countries where there are virtually no educational materials. If we can spread computer literacy, get a few computers there, and get a simple printer, we can get supplemental materials necessary to provide all the textbook support anyone would need, and that plus the technology can leapfrog 20 or 30 or 40 years of development that would otherwise be necessary to give children in schools in developing countries the same sorts of materials that our kids in schools in the United States and Europe and Japan just simply take for granted. So the potential of this all over the world in all kinds of countries at different stages of development is truly staggering, and Intel has made a handsome commitment to it, $300 million over 4 years. Thank you very much. Now we'll go on with the program. Thank you. Wait, before we do that, I forgot, I wanted to say one thing. One of the things that always happens at CGI, and usually in an informal way, but I want to explicitly acknowledge it, is that we try to match, there at any given time, there's some people who come here without a project in mind, but willing to make a commitment of their resources. Others who come here with great ideas with insufficient resources. I just took a picture with one of them a few moments ago, Majora Carter, who runs a program called Sustainable South Bronx. And last year she made a partnership with a businessman from New Jersey who gave her $150,000 to start training people in the poorest congressional district in the United States, provide environmental service and maintenance on a park there in an area which had the smallest amount of green space per person of any congressional district in our country. There are lots of ideas like that. So I just want to point out, we actually brought to this conference people from NGOs from all around the world who are doing fabulous work, who need support. Some of them have already found you and you have found them, and for that I'm very grateful. And I did want to note one thing that's really important to me. I have made a personal commitment to stay with the project of rebuilding New Orleans until it is done. It's the first city I ever saw. In my home, I keep my mother's nursing certificate from Charity Hospital that is now more than 60 years old. The hospital was destroyed in Katrina. And former President Bush and I raised quite a lot of money to keep the schools open, the higher education institutions. But yesterday, Brad Pitt made a remarkable announcement saying that he and Steve Bing would put $5 million each into a matching fund to rebuild homes in the Lower Ninth Ward in the style and size of the previous homes so that the people working there could afford to maintain them, but homes that were not only more resistant to hurricanes but were maximally energy efficient, green homes. I am trying to convince New Orleans to become a green city. We're financing two green schools down there with the Bush Clinton Katrina Fund. And they put this up as a matching grant. So if any of you are interested in that, I want to urge you to support that too. And I have a little money left from that fund that's in my discretion, and I'm going to give them $500,000 from that, and I hope that we can get some others to do that. We need to put these people back in their homes and rebuild New Orleans. It's a unique cultural resource for the United States, and we have to prove that we are not going to walk away from people who were wiped out because of previous errors that were made, not just in the construction of the water protections, but in getting rid of 30 years of wetlands, which caused the water to rush into the city at twice the speed it was otherwise rushed in. Otherwise, only 10% of the damage that was done would have been done. So for those of you who are here from the United States, I would urge you to consider even a modest matching grant, because you know you're going to get a dollar for every dollar you put in, and I hope mine helps. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our panelists, Chairman and Managing Director of Suslon Energy Limited, Tulsi Tanti. President and Chief Executive Officer of MTV Networks, Judy McGarth. President and CEO of the Starbucks Coffee Company, Jim Donald. Chief Executive Officer of Swiss Reinsurance Company, Jacques Agron. And our moderator, founder of the Institute for Strategy and Competitiveness, Harvard Business School, Michael E. Porter.
Well, it's always hard to go after a session like that. I've actually never been able to attend this meeting before, and I asked President Clinton just to stop for a minute and watch the first bit of this session, but I want to congratulate him and his entire team for putting this on. President Clinton and I used to play golf together on New Year's Day a number of years in a row, and I can tell you confidentially that he's a so-so golfer. He's fun, he's energetic, but, you know, results, so-so. But I'll tell you, he's a world-class organizer and motivator, and this thing is just phenomenal. So, President Clinton, congratulations on this whole effort. This session this afternoon is a little bit different than the other sessions you've all attended. You've been going to sessions that have really been organized around particular areas of social concern or social issues, health, climate, poverty, and so forth. This session aims to look across those topics and really look at the role of the corporation as an institution in society to address social needs. Why are we interested in this? Well, we know that corporations have extraordinary resources with which to tackle almost any problem. They have money, they have purchasing power, they have skills, they have managerial capacity. They have all kinds of assets and all kinds of leverage points with which to address social issues. The question is how to actually mobilize the corporation and harness the corporation's capacity in this area. How to really use the market system to address social issues, as well as obviously create the employment and economic growth that we all depend on. So what we have here today is a series of senior business leaders, CEOs, who are really innovators in how to rethink and reshape the role of the corporation in addressing the social agenda items that you've been talking about today, often in a very different context. What I'd like to do is just introduce this panel with just a few thoughts about how I think we are starting to transform and reshape the whole model of how corporations engage society. We've gone through a long history here. I think stage one was the era which I would like to call pressure politics. Corporations resisted addressing these issues. It's not my job. And there were pressure politics of various kinds to kind of cajole and force and embarrass companies into doing something. That was kind of stage one. We moved some time ago into another stage, which I would call sort of the CSR stage. We want to be responsible corporations. We want to have social responsibility departments. We want to really support a lot of charitable causes. And I think we made tremendous headway in that stage, and many companies got much, much more engaged in trying to be sensitive to addressing these social issues. But I think what's happening now is that we're entering really a third stage. And this is the stage which I would call the stage of really shared value. Rather than seeing this as something you have to pressure corporations to do, rather than for corporations to see this as charitable, we're now starting to enter an era where corporations are starting to rethink, the leading ones, are starting to rethink how they can better integrate their connections with society in order to create shared value. Society benefits, the company benefits. Now, what are some of the elements of this new model? Well, I think one of the key elements is it starts with best practices on all the impacts the company has. So companies have to be sensitive to energy use. They have to be sensitive to environmental impact, to wasted packaging, to hiring practices. This new model starts with best practice on all those impacts. But it goes far beyond that now. The new model moves away from PR and branding, which is what a lot of the early CSR thinking was all about. How can we use this to bolster our brand image? To actual social impact. How can we actually make a difference? How can we actually get something done? The model moves from supporting many, many, many social causes with little bits of money and donations and volunteer programs in 25 or 30 different areas to starting to focus the company's efforts on two or three or four areas where they actually have the tools to really make a difference. But make a difference in an area where, again, there's this win-win or shared value opportunity, where it benefits society, but it also benefits the business. And then finally, I would say that this new model requires that companies be very strategic about what social issues they take on. And they select those issues very carefully based on their business, based on the tools and the skills that they have available. I think we have a panel today that will give us a window, a glimpse into this new model. And I'd like to thank all the panelists for being part of today's session. So let's start with Tulsi. Tulsi, can you make money doing social good?
Yes. Our whole business model is to take care of the society, because we are the end-to-end solution provider in wind turbine business, in the global project development in the most of the country. So that's giving the direct business opportunity, but same point of time, we are taking care of the society and environments. So that's the whole business model is giving a unique combinations to create this. The today world has the key challenge, how to create a sustainable development. Keeping in mind the economic growth has to continue, but same point, to take care of the society and environments. So we have a unique opportunity, and we have developed some of the successful business model. We are living and sitting in India, where the whole country is highly dependent on agriculture products and agriculture development. Unfortunately, our industry's growth is 12 to 14%, where our agriculture GDP growth is 3 to 4%. So it's the biggest concern is that how to revive this, because the 80 to 85% populations are living in a rural India. So how to take care of them and to put in such a society level, and the same point to develop the sustainable business model for them. So that's the key challenge for the country is there. So keeping in mind what we are doing, we are developing the project in a rural India, where we are generating the energy. The same point of time, agriculture industry is not getting the sufficient energy, because India has a 16,000 megawatt, the grid deficit in the power. So the priority goes to industries, not to the agriculture. So we are developing the projects in a remote area. So the energy is created. So the agricultures are getting the benefits. The same point, agriculture developments goes on. We creating the rural development and jobs and creations. The same is the important is that the knowledge and expertise are available in rural is missing. So we have to develop the educations and the training and programs so that we can hire those talent to these types of the project and develop that. The same point, the biggest opportunity we found doing these types of the project, the small and medium industries are coming to the rural areas. They are putting their production facilities there because they see the more stability of the power. And they are hedging their power cost for the long terms. So that is the biggest advantage is coming. So that's not become a big burden to the cities. If those populations come to the migrate to the cities, it's the biggest chaos is becoming. So to retain those populations and do the rural industries development and same point of the agriculture development and society integration. So it's giving a unique benefit in a three aspects. The society development, the same point of is economy of the country's development and giving the energy security for the nations. And the same point of time, we are taking care of the biggest challenge of the world today. We have a global warming and climate change concerns. We are mitigating those things because it's a CO2P, the power productions. So that's the giving the very good sustainable growth. It's very, very important we have observed. And now we are implementing this same concept of the model on different part of the world. So that can give the more sustainability in going long terms.
Right.
And same point time, we are doing business and making good profits.
Great. It's interesting. You're in the business of social benefit, in the business of renewable energy. And so we're seeing more and more businesses where actually the product is social benefit, like in your case. Jim Donald of Starbucks, what area has Starbucks chosen to really focus on in terms of trying to make this match between society and the company's business?
Well, first of all, we're a coffee company, and coffee is at the core of what the company sells and what we stand for. And our, and the words scalable and sustainable, I've heard throughout the last day and a half, but our business depends upon the sustainability of the coffee supply. And we like to say that our success is directly linked to the success of the farmer, not only in what they get paid, but having the ability to grow the capacity of that farmer and create this shared value. And if you take a step back, 17 years ago, Howard Schultz and the few that were around then, because Starbucks was a much smaller company, came up with six guiding principles to really integrate and make part of a business strategy these guiding principles. And one of those guiding principles was giving back to the communities that we operate in, whether it's a store in Manhattan or whether it's a farm in Ethiopia. And from those guiding principles, Starbucks has made investments through what we call CAFE practices, which are our buying guidelines. And CAFE stands for Coffee and Farmer Equity. But these buying guidelines that we put together with Conservation International really protect the farmer in many different ways that creates this sustainability. It ensures that the quality of the coffee is at Starbucks quality. It ensures economic transparency so we can see what the farmer is getting paid. But it also works on the environmental piece for the farmer, making sure that irrigation is done properly, that water courses are protected, making sure we evaluate and monitor the use of pesticides. But as important, we also monitor the social conditions of the communities, providing children with educational facilities or health care, making sure there's no child labor on the farms. And so when we're able to put these practices in place, and I'm proud to say that over 60% of our coffee is purchased through CAFE practices, our farmers receive a premium price for their coffee. Their communities are created with a sustainable impact, and the land upon which they grow the coffee will be around for a long time as we continue to grow our store count and grow our business.
Are there any other areas besides the procurement, which I think has been the sort of hallmark of Starbucks' approach? Is there any areas besides procurement that you're, trying to integrate the social and the business?
Yes, there's several areas of what we look at. And again, it's part of a strategy, not just a marketing type of effort. And other areas of what we do is providing developing countries with access to water, teaching children in these areas, women in these areas, how to manage farms. And this is all part of creating what we think is not only good for the business, but good for those communities that we operate in.
Okay, thanks, Jim. So we've heard from a renewable energy producer and technology provider. We've heard from Starbucks, who's selling a product that's often produced in developing countries and is trying to use its procurement to kind of integrate the social and the business. Jacques, you're the CEO of a major world-class reinsurance company. That seems pretty far away from social issues. Can you actually make money doing social good?
Well, I'm tempted to say in our case it was really a matter of putting our mouth where our money was, and that form of expression is not caused by my bad English. For once, it's actually exactly what I mean. We already had the money, meaning taking the risk associated to natural catastrophes. We are the payer if catastrophes strike. And thus, already in the early 90s, we associated ourselves to a major effort of risk awareness. Risk-taking is our business. So making money out of risk was our business anyway. That's all what we do. But building awareness of the matters related to climate change much earlier than the political agenda, which has developed beautifully during the last years, was essential in a very selfish manner. So we built it step by step. It became a major value proposition in terms of actually making a number of risks insurable, which otherwise would not be. And frankly, making risk insurable means more business, which is a wonderful way to improve your profits, and also actually solving a considerable amount of problems for the people who were exposed to those risks before. So there was a natural linkage between the business we have been in for 140 years and the duty of speaking about it, building this awareness, cooperating with public voices, and actually step-by-step developing mitigating solutions.
So basically you focused on climate change as the area that's most integrated and connected to what you've always done. Tell us about some of the products that you've actually developed around that area of climate change, new products that you wouldn't have thought of if you were not really seeing it this way.
It unfortunately would get very quickly extraordinarily esoteric and thus perfectly boring for everyone. So I will keep it at the somewhat superficial level. But in a way, it's making a number of sustainable solutions in the field of energy efficiencies, making engineering solutions in terms of preventions, mitigations of risks, facilitating the development of seawalls, facilitating the awareness at the level of local communities of building codes which would be more relevant. All of those points are actually in those lines. But it is also actually linking directly to Tusslin type of business, finding new ways to ensure a totally new energetic solutions. Windmills were not easy to evaluate, where you have a totally new type of engineering problems. You don't quite know what can happen in terms of damages, in terms of risk, in terms of breakdown. And so you have to work with the specialized experts in developing insurance solutions so that actually the operators which are using those windmills, both at the local, more farm communities and in very, very, very large places, if I correctly understand the business models, can actually have a valid value propositions for what are huge investments up front and that we obviously want to be somewhat protected and mitigated in terms of financial risks.
Yep. Great. Judy, you're in a company that's not a giant company with procurement around the world. You're not in the business of dealing with risks that can be connected to the climate. MTV is a very distinctive and very important company. But it's in some ways it's different than the other companies here. How have you been able to think about this question of connecting your business to society?
Well, first I resisted getting one of the Comedy Central writers to write me a funny opening line for this because initially I thought I was kind of the odd woman out here. But I think that actually, MTV Networks in particular and media in general really have a lot to do in this area that's... our business is really relevant and authenticity, primarily with young adults and kids, through Nickelodeon, MTV, VH1, Comedy Central. And when you're in the business of relevance with young adults, nothing matters more to them than issues that have social impact and consequences. I think what's been unique about us is that because we're an entertainment company, we find ways to connect around issues that are in a voice that makes sense to them. So from the earliest days, I mean, it's been very good for the business of MTV to be global. I mean, we offer reach in an extraordinary way. We're in, you know, over 500 million homes around the world. We have, you know, almost 300 websites. We are 80 mobile deals. We have, I believe we're in 160 territories, 32 languages. People are called to prayer on MTV in Muslim countries. It's not franchised the same way everywhere we go. It is, a lot of work goes into making it relevant to wherever we are. So from the earliest days, very early, I think MTV was actually one of the first broadcasters to really step out actively around HIV/AIDS and the impact it was having on young people. We would start by doing a ton of research, what is on their minds. And generally, it's issues of sexual health and identity. That was a very big issue over the last, you know, 20 years, let's say, of MTV. So, you know, whether we're in Bangalore or Buenos Aires or London or New York, you'll see very active messaging that is pervasive and continual and goes on year after year, because that's what it takes, I think, to connect. And what's been good for our business, I think, is that we are both a mirror and a window on the culture. You know, the mirror piece is reflecting what young adults are interested in and all about right this minute. And the window is the opportunity you have to take that and maybe push them in a direction a little bit, lead them to an organization, or give them, you know, the tools to start making social change in their own lives. You know, we learned that when we looked at, you know, the best ways to do this, and I won't go on here, but there were sort of four simple things that came up, which I actually think work internally inside a corporation like ours. It requires, at first, starting early. You know, Nickelodeon is full of programming about, you know, the global warming, which is clearly the number one issue on the minds of kids and young adults all around the world from all of our research. You know, they have a Let's Just Play Day where we're going off the air, so kids will go outside this coming weekend. You know, they have the Big Help where kids volunteer, so you start early. Then they need encouragement. You have to, as a media person in this space, continually encourage, you know, behavior, activity, connection. They need specific direction. So the fantastic time we're in now, where the internet is exploding and communities are forming around issues, it's much easier to connect, you know, people to organizations, activities, things that will touch them personally, which is another piece of it. People, in our research, young adults believe global warming is touching them in a very personal way. And so they're very interested in taking that on. And then lastly, like flexibility. You know, you can't do it in a tone that's, you know, you need to do this way. You know, it's sort of, you need to make it possible for people to take this into their own hands. And in so doing, you know, I think from the earliest days of, whether it's, you know, Break the Addiction, which is like a 12-step program MTV is running globally now about how things to do every day to make your life less dependent on, you know, energy and more green, lean into green, if you will, to the next season of The Real World, which will be in a house that's built completely to be a green house, if you will, to, you know, Save the Music, which former President Clinton has been such a big part of over at VH1, you know, which has raised $40 million for public school programs, music programs, and has attracted plenty of advertisers to our company in so doing. So it's good for business. It makes the people who work for us feel like they're doing something that is relevant to them, and it certainly keeps the audience coming back, you know, for almost 30 years now.
Yep. So it's interesting. So we have one company that actually makes what most people would argue as a really social issue, its value proposition, renewable energy. But another company that says, I depend in procurement on communities that need tremendous help. Let's make that our signature. We have another company that's in the risk business that says, my gosh, where can we really make a difference? Well, in helping to understand and then helpfully providing tools to mitigate and address and improve this risk. And now a media company says, well, where can we play? Well, we can play by influencing people and mobilizing young people and giving them ways of in their own lives of engaging these issues. And Judy says, gosh, it's pretty good for our business to do that. Advertisers love it because the more we can connect with our viewers, the more advertisers want to be part of it. Now, let's extend the last discussion. So Jacques, this work you've done on climate change and trying to bring insight and new products into mitigating climate risk, how does that really benefit your company? Tell us about how that's really been good for the company.
Again, two different dimensions. I will start with actually one formidable side effect exactly in the same line as mentioned by Judy a minute ago, which is it's really one of the most formidable employee value propositions that you can get. We are in an industry which is very wholesale. We have a huge density of highly trained university graduates, and from the reputation of the firm and thus attracting the best talent, it has been extraordinarily beneficial. It moves the topic from what seems difficult to relate to something which suddenly attracts attention on the part of young minds and young talents, which then can discover actually something that they may not have thought about earlier. On the business front, again, widening the circle of awareness with regard to climate change and its consequences has led to a huge expansion, actually, of the business opportunities worldwide. If I consider a business in China, the developments are even faster than the local economy. It's both related to the normal wealth factors, but it's also related to the fact that there is a natural tendency in every part of the world, well known in this country with regard to Florida, to congregate in areas which are close to the shore and which ends up being actually the most exposed to natural risks. It has a lot of logical reasons. It is not irrational, but it does create some interesting challenges, which if you can provide the solutions in terms of the financial mitigations, which is our business, can become actually a very positive outcome of this effort and this long journey that we have had for the past 17 years.
How do you try to get your employees involved in this agenda, in these efforts? They kind of the rank and file.
In different fashions. First thing is that we really work very hard in making sure that the company was carbon neutral. To be frank, it's pretty easy. We're not a manufacturing entity, so it's basically travel and buildings. But it works pretty well, and you get plenty of ideas from the employees themselves on how to achieve it. And it has been substantially achieved in most of our major locations. And I think that, frankly, there as well, the connections between making something that is ecologically friendly and making it beautiful and making money out of it works. We are quite proud of our company architectures in many places, and many of you may know our building in London, the Gherkin. That's a building which uses less than 50% energy consumption than any equivalent building in the City of London. It is quite a stunning landmark. The employees are extraordinarily happy to work in it. It has a level of light which is wonderful, and it works very well. And frankly, we made a bundle when we sold the space to a real estate investor. 2 years after having completed it, and we continue, of course, to use it as our local office building. The second thing is that we got our employees to relate to the effort by actually launching 2 years ago a program which was substantially motivated by the CGI, actually, which we called COU2, and which consists in actually offering to any employees anywhere in the world, which was a bit unique at the time, financial contributions for any activities that they would choose to make, which was related to sustainability, either by giving their time and getting a paid holiday from us to contribute to an effort, or by, at the other end, buying a hybrid car rather than a normal car for the next car. So it's a pure supplementary expense. You can look at it as a negative in terms of a strict P&L, but the level of enthusiasm that it has created throughout the firm, and actually the number of clients of ours which have come forward and asked for how could we actually imitate, and we love the copycat in that case, has been very, very rewarding.
Could I add to that? We, as I mentioned, the whole procurement side of our business, the engine of our company is our retail stores. And Judy, your base of viewers are my partners. We call our employees partners. And our average age of our partners is about 27 years old, and 42% of our partners in North America are university students. And they expect a company to be a company that they can respect, and that this actually by taking the steps that we do to integrate into our business model, our corporate social responsibility, this has served as a retention and an attraction device for us as we open up stores from just starting with 3 stores to now around 15,000 stores and growing with over 200,000 partners. It's been able to give us that leg up, if you will, on the retention of these partners that are so desperately needed. I was in San Francisco. We just purchased Ethos and provided a $10 million commitment to bringing water to developing countries. And the store manager, who was a pre-med student, she goes, "I'm putting pre-med on hold." And I said, "Why is that?" She goes, "I love what you're doing. I want to work for your corporate social responsibility department, and I want to continue to grow in my job and then beyond with Starbucks." So by providing access to the communication of what you're doing, and as a company doing the right thing to create sustainability for the environment, for our farmers, for our supply, the end result is you have a group of partners that actually not only you retain them, but they are part of the communication process, and that's our marketing vehicle to talk about some of the things that we do.
Thank you. Well, we have very limited time, and I see to my dismay that President Clinton actually took a little bit of our time, so we have even less time than I thought, roughly 13 minutes. So we've kind of talked about here so far the affirmative case of how to create this win-win shared value opportunity. Again, not for a company to try to do good in every possible way to support every possible worthy cause. That's not the way to go. What we've heard here is much more focused efforts on the part of the company to really get engaged in issues where it can really make a difference. And I think we've seen that has multiple benefits. Most of the people in this room, or a lot of the people in this room, are from NGOs or from government. And at the risk of being a little bit provocative here, I'd like to actually turn the discussion to those entities. And maybe, Judy, turn to you. So is the NGO community helping or hurting the movement of companies to proceed in this direction?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, for all of the years that we've been doing this work on all of our various brands, the NGOs, the nonprofit community, have been an incredible partner resource for us. We've worked with so many, you know, we've had great partnerships with many of them. And when we sit at the same table and really begin to, you know, align our goals and talk openly and brainstorm. It's been fantastic. But on the other hand, this morning when I got up, I noticed the New York Times has an article about something MTV is launching called Think, which is a social network designed to encourage activism and do it in a way that's very compelling. You know, it's pretty much a recommendation culture online, so you know, you can go to this site and recommend places to go, you can access information, you can link to all kinds of organizations, but it was supported with funding and support from the Gates Foundation, the Case Foundation. So the New York Times has an article that really takes us to task as a for-profit company lining up with other big, you know, not-for-profit organizations and, in a sense, maybe cutting out some other people who are, you know, quoted in the article who feel that maybe this is not great. You know, they didn't get the opportunity to work with Gates, and what does MTV need Gates for? And, you know, I mean, the article is sort of balanced. You can see both sides of the equation. I totally understand and respect that point of view. You know, at the same time, you would hope that when people who have reach and resources band together, it lifts everything for everyone to some extent. But I do feel like there's a certain inherent criticism, skepticism, wariness, you know, of what exactly are you, you know, even if your motives are good, it would be better if there wasn't any component of this that involved, you know, profit for your company, you know, which is frankly just not the rules we have to live by.
Jim, how could NGOs add more value to what your company's trying to do?
There is a long list of partnerships that and NGOs that we have worked with to be able to create the sustainability of our farms, communities, and even providing access to credit. And if you just start with, just to name a few, Conservation International, that was key in helping us develop these coffee buying practices and roll them out in Latin America, in Central America. We're also, and we've made a commitment to double our coffee purchases in East Africa over the next 2 years. And we couldn't do that without the African Wildlife Foundation, who's going to help us integrate these buying practices into our farms in East Africa. We also use Echologic, and we've provided over $10 million of access to credit for our farmers to bridge them, if you will, from season to season. And part of our commitment to East Africa was also another $1 million that they're going to help us make sure that it gets in the right hands. And there's companies like CARE who have been instrumental in helping us with our water projects as we roll those out. So they provide us with a full comprehensive view of what's happening on the ground, so we're able to use our Starbucks influence, their expertise, and create the sustainability or the shared value, if you will.
How can they do it better, Jim?
I think if you were to ask an NGO, how can you do it better, we'd have to ask ourselves that same question. And it is clearly a partnership that needs to be discussed at the table, behind closed doors, going through all the key points that would help make each side work that much better, keeping in mind what that end result was.
Good. Let's turn to government. And Tulsi, could you comment? What do we need government to do to get companies more focused and more able to kind of pursue this dual agenda that we've been talking about?
Yeah, the today we have a key challenge, and when we are talking in the last 2 days, we are listening, the global warming and climate change is a serious concern, and in the word of the Al Gore, it's a real emergency. So it's a time for the actions. We realizing as a industries or as a corporate, our lot of initiatives are very strong compared to the government initiatives. So it is a very high time government and private sector has to work together and to work out the policy frameworks. It's very, very important is there. Like the CDM is there, Kyoto Protocol, but the most of the nations are working, but a lot of things are not going with the line with that. The same point of them, implementation and process is so complex, so it's not efficiently output is coming. So it's a very high time to frame the global policy network, which can give the clear direction not for the one nation, but for the whole world. how to mitigate this risk and to create a sustainable development.
Let's talk about that. That is the clear
policy frameworks are required.
Let's talk about your business. You're in the business of enabling and participating in wind power developments in India and in a variety of different parts of the world. So what kind of policy framework are you talking about?
Yeah, the first is that the global understanding should be it is a global issues and global framework is required. Now, keeping in mind, there is always this debate is going whether we should give an incentive or whether we should give the CO2 tax. We recommend it should be the both way. The one part, those are polluting the environment, there should be a CO2 tax. And the same point, a lot of investment is required in a technology and innovation and development. So the some preferential benefit should be given to the renewables. So the policy framework should be like that. A 20% across the world, irrespective of the any countries, the minimum has to come from the renewable, and 20% greenhouse gas should be reduced. It should be not one country's target, but it should be a global target, because the whole environment issue is not affecting to the any individual or any country. It's a global concern is there. So the 20% minimum RPS for the global perspective is required. The second thing is the preferential tariff should be given across the world, because a lot of countries, different initiatives, and that's why the very piecemeal developments are going on, because each countries are accelerating growth, other countries are not accelerating growth. So that's not giving a uniform development. So it should be the preferential tariff across the world.
So governments need to put in place a policy framework, whatever it is, so that you know what it is, so that it's clear, so that it's set, and then the private sector and the business community can take action. Ideally, that framework could be consistent across countries. And you also said something important. And then, of course, when we try to develop these projects, there's a massive, complex implementation process, again, partly because of government making you go through a bunch of steps. Let's simplify the implementation. Jacques, what would you say about government? What do you need from government to actually turn the corporation into an engine for social progress as opposed to a kind of a wary participant?
Well, first, at the macro level, any solutions is indeed a cooperation between the private and the public sector. We need the public sector is the only one to set the framework, to be able to set policies that we can rely on for projects, investments, decisions, in our case, risk-taking, which has consequences over many years. We need to know what is the likely environment from a legal standpoint down the road. We can take many uncertainty, it's our business, but the legal uncertainty should not be the constraint. And that the government can help and actually are making progress, but it goes very much to what Vice President Dalgo was saying yesterday or what the Prime Minister of Norway was saying this morning. We can live with almost any kind of framework as long as there is stability and certainty and that you are not changing the game in the middle. So if you allow me one particular point, which is an uncomfortable one that is not being spoken about very often. Everybody is saying coal will continue to be part of the solutions. It's realistic. It's almost impossible to imagine that you could have in actually any of the four largest countries from that standpoint, meaning the USA, Russia, China, India, the appropriate utilities without using coal on a large scale. Thus, CO2 sequestration is one of the absolutely key technological developments. There is no debate from a technology standpoint, from a political standpoint, that this is a big effort to be made. And there are progress on the technology. What is a problem is that no utilities company in the private sector in its right mind can actually take the risk of a change in the legal situations about the interpretations of the environmental damage that may or may not exist 25, 30, 50 years down the road about the way the CO2 has been sequestrated. So there is a risk, no doubt. We don't know what it will exactly be, but we won't even see a start of a process if there is not enough certainty about what would be the legal consequences down the road. And frankly, it translates from an insurance perspective, in fact, that the project becomes insurable or uninsurable as a result as well. If you allow me to actually jump back to your point on the NGOs, because there are, I have two very positive messages. In our case, we've had the cooperation with NGOs, in particular the climate group, but also a number of other parties. The risk awareness during what was frankly a long process with speaking in a vacuum for a while until the early 2000s would have been impossible. So the NGO was absolutely critical to carry the message and build it up in terms of awareness. And then at this stage, we now are moving to actually mitigations with solutions. And for example, we are launching a climate adaptation program in cooperation with another NGO called Millennium Promise and with the Columbia Earth Institute, which in that case is providing solutions for alleviating poverty and related to climate changes by offering effectively insurance solutions, applies micro-insurance solutions applied to weather patterns. And the idea is that we can provide, thanks to a mix of insurance and financial markets techniques, amounts of finance in case the weather is either too dry or too wet, and the poor farmers in India, in Africa, in Asia, would actually fall into the final poverty trap unless we can actually prevent it by giving them an amount of finance in the case the weather pattern has been restrictive. We could not do that without the NGOs. They have the access to the network. They have the capability to distribute. What we can provide them, which is a positive development, is actually the technical solutions.
Yep. Well, we have just a few minutes, seconds left. Could we each take a second here? Suppose you were talking to a company sitting in this room, and you were trying to encourage and help that company really step up its social initiatives and kind of build this connection between business and social that we've been talking about. You know, what advice would you give? Let's start with Judy. What advice would you give at any company that wants to build this shared value approach?
I think you should start with something that rings true to the values of your company, and because if it doesn't, it will not feel sincere, I think, to anyone involved in it. And I think you should do a fair amount of research to make sure you're using your considerable resources in a way that really might have some impact and some relevance. And I think you should, you know, do something you're passionate about. You know, you listen to these gentlemen on this panel speaking, they're all very engaged in this for a lot of different reasons. So I actually think it's one of the great privileges of being in a corporation to approach it that way. You have choice.
Yeah. Tulsi?
I strongly recommend when we have the key global concern is there, the governments and corporate house has to strongly focus on the renewable development more and more and to accelerate that growth and the speed so that the huge social, economical, sustainable development is achievable. So we have to encourage that more and more. And I recommend to the media has to communicate and create a strong awareness, the value creations for all the societies, how it can be benefit. So the execution part of the projects can go at very strongly. And message from the media to the governments and policymakers so that they can implement the systems and process and regulatory framework well in advance so that we can execute the very strong development of the renewables in the world and we can mitigate this issue very fast.
Jack?
Well, I join actually, Judy, and importantly the opening statement that you had made. It has to go quite far away from the traditional charity. You can do that. It's very, very useful. You can encourage your employees and to participate in charitable efforts. But if you can relate it, if you can relate your entire efforts to something which has a direct impact on the company, you then indeed can speak with an enthusiasm, you can engage in a totally different manner. So each company will have a slightly different way to play, depending upon their businesses, but you can only maintain the momentum through the organization over many years if it truly is correlated to your business activities.
Jim?
Three things. Narrow your focus, embed it in your strategies, and turn your employees loose. And that's how I think you'll get the biggest impact of really creating change, but also it's good for the business.
Terrific. Well, we're out of time, and I know that everybody's had a long day. I want to thank our panel for their terrific remarks, and I hope that all of you in the audience will try to find a way in whatever field you're in to kind of apply some of these principles and move in this direction. So thanks for being here.
Ladies and gentlemen, the plenary session is now concluded. Please enjoy the taste of a world reception across the hall beginning right now. You'll find samplings from many of the finest restaurants and chefs in New York, including Nobu, El Molino, Rosa Mexicana.